You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, it's Holly with a note about this episode. We recorded our interview with Glenn Sobel pre-pandemic. We talked about his upcoming tour with Alice Cooper, which was supposed to have started this month, and many of the other concerts Dave and I had planned to see this summer. We didn't want to edit it out because we felt it was integral to the episode, even though, sadly, all tours have been postponed.
And so this is Dave, and with that said, Holly, let's get started with the What Difference Does It Make podcast. Let's get to Alice. What was the audition like for that? I mean, what do you do
there really
for that?
Wasn't.
Okay, there was. Okay.
Not a traditional audition like you'd think. In fact, most people hate auditions.
I would imagine so.
Yeah, and I'm glad that there wasn't. Just, there's so much guesswork in an audition, and so many people would agree with me. They'd want the artist or whoever to say, this is how we want to do this, just like this one live recording. But there's just a lot of guesswork, and there's management and label people that aren't musicians that are hearing with their eyes. They don't know who's a better musician. They just think like, oh, well, that person looks like, it's like casting a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Looks and, the part.
Yeah. And the more non-musicians you have in that room, the more the image is going to dictate who's getting a gig. And that is important. It's show business where it's a visual medium. But with Alice, the first thing I ever did for him was something where I never met him. It was a recording. This is 2010 in Nashville. My good friend of 30 years now, which is crazy to think, but Tommy Hendrickson, he's a guy I've played in different bands with, and he became a producer. Producers are the guys that get the session players on the gig to record for whoever the star, the singer is, whatever. And so Tommy was living in Nashville. He was working with Bob Ezrin, who produced Alice's big hits back in the day. In fact, I'm 18 was Bob Ezrin's first hit as a producer, and it was Alice's first hit. So, and Bob went on to do Pink Floyd, The Wall, and Kiss Destroyer, Peter Gabriel, just a lot of legendary stuff. So he was overseeing this recording that Tommy brought me into. Tommy was Bob's sort of right-hand guy. And we were doing note-for-note remakes of School's Out, No More Mr. Nice Guy, a few of the classics. And Alice was re-singing it. And the question is, why? Why do that? Well, if a movie or a commercial or a video game wants these songs, now the artist has this newly recorded master, a knockoff, but you're supposed to fool people into thinking they're hearing the original or a remastered version of the original. When I had to actually chart out, not just chart out, but notate, note for note, what Neil Smith, the original drummer, was playing. And so I had a crash course in Alice Cooper just from doing that session. And it went off pretty well. I mean, it was just verbatim playing these parts. And it was with Reb Beach on guitar from Winger, and he played in Alice for a good while. Great guy and player. And Greg Smith, and another Alice alumni that now plays with Ted Nugent. I was the only guy that had not played with Alice on this session, but we had a blast. We had to recreate the 70s with the drum tones, and we had the original producer where if you don't show up prepared, he'll yell at you, but I already kind of knew that ahead of time. And no, we had a good time, and it went well enough to where a year later they were asking Bob Ezrin to produce the show. And he said, okay, but he wasn't liking the lineup, the current lineup. He wanted to make some changes. And he said to Tommy, my buddy, he said, yeah, what about your buddy Glenn that did the recordings last year, the remakes? And Alice said, well, I heard him. I sang over his tracks, but I didn't see him. I got to see him. My drummer's got to be flashy. And so Tommy pulled up some YouTube right then and there. I think they were working on Alice's latest studio recording in Nashville. This is 2011. And based on Tommy showing him whatever video, I don't know what, some drum solo thing, I guess the drum solo did help get me a gig. But the substance was that recording. That's, I count that as 80% of it. The other 20% being Alice being able to see that I'm not some boring looking guy on the drums, and then Tommy vouching for my character. I'm not crazy. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm reliable. All that. That goes a long way. In fact, that's what many people lack in this business, and they wonder why they don't get work. The reliability thing. But Tommy called me. He said, I'm sitting here with Mr. Cooper and we're looking at your videos and you want to do this gig? And I was asleep in LA. It was 2 hours earlier. I said, yeah, man, let's do it. And he went, all right, you're in. Click. And it was basically, that was it.
Wow.
And I met Alice on the first day of rehearsal, which was the following April in Nashville.
What were you doing at the time? What was your gig? Were you playing at the time?
I had come off of that Vasco Rossi tour not long before that, the big Italian guy, because that was at the end of 2010, and this was early 2011 when all this went down. So
good timing.
Yeah, it was. And I just remember coming home from that Italian thing going, oh, I just did this amazing thing, and it was like stadiums and arenas, and I did 5 weeks and helped save the tour, and nobody knows in America because it's an artist that just plays over there in Italy for the most part. So it was nice to finally get on a gig that was obviously an iconic rock star that's known the world over.
And you're entering your 10th year now.
Yeah.
I mean, that's crazy.
I know.
So what is the secret? I mean, he's still playing big arenas. He's playing the Hollywood Bowl this summer. I mean,
which means you're playing the Hollywood Bowl this summer.
I mean, you've done this, you've done it before, but what keeps this fresh? I mean, is it Alice who's keeping it fresh? Is it the musicians are challenging each other?
Yeah. It's all that. Yeah, Alice still loves to work. He doesn't have to do as many shows per year that we do, but we're knocking out, could be 80 to 100 shows in a year, which is definitely a lot. You got to keep your sanity. But the Hollywood Bowl, that is May 31st. They just officially announced that summer tour the other day. It's Alice headlining, and then it's Tesla and Lita Ford. And we're friends with like all the guys in those bands. That's going to be a fun hang.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it'll be the first time Alice has headlined Hollywood Bowl since 1973.
He didn't headline the last time?
Who played there with Motley Crue.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So this is a headline. Oh, wow. So this is huge.
Yeah. Yeah, it keeps getting bigger venues in certain cities. Like 2017 and 18. Well, 2017 we did Greek Theater with Deep Purple. And it was a double bill, but they would close the show every night. But then 2018, we did headline Greek Theater. It got a little bigger. And then 2019, last year, we did Hollywood Vampires at the Greek Theater, our own show. But now it's Alice at Hollywood Bowl. So this is a good package tour. This is like a good ticket that people will want to buy. You know, Tesla's a great band. They got 4 out of 5 original people, a lot of hits, great guys. And Lita Ford, of course, everybody knows her. And
did you ever see Tesla?
Sure.
You went
Actually, Troy Lakeda, I've known since I'm practically a kid, the drummer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was so supportive early on. I did a recording with his cousin, who's a really great guitarist and also played bass. And I did a demo with Troy's cousin to promote myself. Like, here's me playing music in a bunch of different styles. And this costs some money, but this was social networking back in the day. I had to go into a studio, like a formal studio, and hire this guitar player and tell him what I want to do. I want to do this straight up rock tune. I want to do a ballad. I want to do something more jazzy. I want to do something funky. And then I had to have the engineer after the fact crossfade all these mini tunes together. One fades out, one fades in. It was a demo for myself, basically. And the guitarist, Scott, he said, you know, my cousin's Troy Lakeda from Tesla. And this was when they were all over MTV. He said, I'm going to give him this cassette. And one day out of the blue, Troy called me when I was like 21 or so, and said, hey, I heard your tape. Sounding great. Keep doing what you're doing. You're on the right track. And we've been friends ever since. So this will be nice to tour together.
That's a really nice thing to do for a musician. I mean, that's very supportive. You
need to know from somebody who's doing it for real that you're on the right track, that you're not going down the wrong road. It's true.
You do have a nice clique of friends. Every December, don't you, all your drummer friends get together? What's that about?
The 818 drummer's lunch?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's been January when we've been able to do it. Like, we just did one. We're taping this on, what is today, January 24th?
Yeah.
Right? So we just did one because of the NAMM convention. That's National Association of Music Merchants. It's the trade show for the music industry. It's in Anaheim every year, and people come in. They come in from all over the world. So it's a good time to do the lunch. So this is, again, San Fernando Valley, West Valley, at a certain restaurant that lets us do our thing there. They got a patio, and on a random Tuesday afternoon, all of a sudden, all these drummers, a lot dressed in black, and they're coming in, and people are probably going, what is happening? And we're noisy, of course, but it's just a very nice camaraderie that drummers have that maybe you don't see so much in other instruments, guitar, bass. Not to say that they hate each other, but drummers like to get together and hang. And so this started years ago. It was myself, and it was Jordan Burns, who for a long time was in the band Strung Out, West San Fernando Valley punk band. They influenced a lot of people. I mean, Blink 182 used to open for them, bands like that. And Jordan and then Dean Butterworth, we started it. Dean plays in Good Charlotte and Sugar Ray. Him and I used to share a practice space, but the three of us would go to lunch and goof off, and then we'd invite other guys that lived in the area, and it just kept growing, and it turned into a thing.
Can you tell us the restaurant?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's
just shout out.
Always at Stonefire Grill in West Hills. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
We don't put it out on social media beforehand. We put it out afterwards.
You know. We're going to stalk you next January.
No, we get some great people showing up. A lot of brand new guys, but like Denny Sywell lives in the area. He played with Wings. He's the guy on Live and Let Die. And Ralph Johnson, my buddy Ralph, he's a West Valley guy. He's Earth, Wind, and Fire since 71. And they loved it. And then they loved mixing it up with all the new guys. And it was just so great to see.
People think nothing happens in the Valley.
That's right.
Oh, they're wrong.
Happening place. Let's go on influences. Just, you've met so many drummers. There's a lot of drummers that you haven't met that you probably wish you had. You had touched on one of the first singles you bought. Can you talk a little bit about that and the influence possibly that this drummer had on your life?
Are we talking about Rush?
Yeah, I believe so.
Of course, yeah. I mean, that's just such a typical story, but it's true that so many of us started playing because of Neil Peart, and we did just lose him, and it was it cast a heavy cloud over the week that was the NAMM convention, because that was what was happening right after his passing. And so there was no time for people to put any formal tributes together, but he was definitely the talk of everybody. I mean, it's just a thing. Everyone started because of something. And for guys anywhere near the age of us, it was because of him. And I think he just got sick of hearing that. I mean, that was the famous thing with Neil Peart. If you meet him, don't start gushing all over him about how he's the reason you started playing. He'll turn right off. It's in limelight, the lyrics. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't pretend a stranger is a long-awaited friend.
That's true.
He writes about it.
As a professional drummer, what is it that you hear in Neil Peart that influences you or that you get that inspires you? I mean, I'm sure you still listen to his records. Like, how did he do that? Or wow, how did he plan this out?
Well, at my residency gig, which usually it's the last Wednesday of the month, but we did one during NAMM week. There was a set in the middle where there was a bunch of Rush tunes performed and several drummers participated. We didn't advertise it. We didn't want to like exploit anything, but it just seemed like a thing people wanted to do. So I played Limelight. And so it's like, okay, I haven't ever really played the whole song all the way through. I got to sit there and really dissect every little part. And even that song, that's challenging. That's not like Xanadu, one of their most challenging, but it's like, wow, these are really cleverly orchestrated parts, and his transitions and fills were just so unusual, but became so known to everybody with all the people air drumming out there. And there's not one Rush song that isn't challenging in one way or another, but he wasn't always playing busy. He had really just expertly crafted parts that fit the songs. And it's things that you might not have ever thought of yourself, but he did, with this crazy power trill, with the guy with the voice sounding like he's on helium. You know, who would have thought that this would have been such a iconic, huge band, but they are.
Certainly their label didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, they probably had it rough. I mean, everybody that had a different sound early on in their career, they were told no a lot.
This seems like a really good time to take a break. We will be right back.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Welcome back to What Difference Does It Make? And our interview with drummer Glenn Sobel.
When you were on Warner Brothers with Beautiful Creatures, mm-hmm. what was that experience like with a band that was on a major label that
learned had, a lot?
Yeah,
definitely learned a lot. And this was a very 80s influence group. Basically, the two big influences of that were Guns N' Roses, AC/DC with a modern vibe. And this was 2001 when we had that record deal. We did Ozfest. And just, boy, that was a crash course in the music industry. Of course, everything's very different now, but learned a lot about what not to do. But there was a point where I had joined the band, and I just got called to do it. I guess there was an audition, but they weren't, like, calling a bunch of people. This was a guitar player, DJ Ashba, I've known forever. I had played with him in his instrumental trio, like, I don't know, 5 years before joining Beautiful Creatures. I got the call from him and the A&R guy, who I also knew a little bit. That's a whole nother story where the A&R guy thought he was in the band and it was a frustrated drummer. Jeez. But no, it was a great experience, and that's another one of my favorite records I've ever played on. There's still people all over the world that every now and then they'll come up with a CD of that for me to sign. It definitely has a following, and by this time in 01, I think Warner Brothers was thinking a couple things. Like, okay, grunge has been around now almost 10 years. It really erased the slate. Maybe it's time to bring back some good time rock with guitar solos. And this was Warner Brothers' reason to do that. And the band Buck Cherry was out. Mm-hmm. And they had some success on the first record. So their second record, we had our fingers crossed that that was going to do really well because that would be good for us. That's the way label people think. Well, that's big, and we got something that sounds like that, so we're going to put money into that. I mean, there's no rhyme or reason. They don't know what they're doing half the time. If something is successful, they all want to take credit, and if it fails, it's the artist's fault. The record business is a lot of guessing and throwing things up against the wall and seeing what sticks. Mm-hmm. But we made a very cool record, and we had a great producer that was able to navigate our crazy A&R guy that fancied himself a writer and a producer. And we got out on Ozfest. And at first we thought, oh, we're dead. This is Ozfest. We're on the second stage with Hatebreed and Slipknot's on the main stage. And there's all these heavy bands. Oh, we're dead. But no, it actually worked in our favor. We were unlike anybody else. And actually, there was a lot of commercial acts on the bill that year. Linkin Park was there, and Disturbed and Crazy Town, and Marilyn Manson was on the bill. So it was actually a good mix of hard rock and heavy metal styles, and we just stood out. And we had a great time just proving ourselves every day on that tour. And sometimes we'd be on as early as 10 in the morning. Mm-hmm. They'd rotate, or sometimes as late as 2 in the afternoon. Yeah, at 10 in the morning, there's kids lined
people
up
showing, yeah.
ready to come in and mosh. I just want to go, wait, pace yourself. Black Sabbath isn't on for another 10 hours, you know. But yeah, our manager was Geezer Butler's wife, Gloria Butler. And that's how she was able to get us onto the tour that year. And like I said, we learned a lot, because before we hired her as our manager, there was no manager. I joined when they were between management. So all these managers came to our rehearsal room and met with us, and all these producers too. And we'd sit and we'd talk with them. There's one certain very big manager that we had like a 5-hour meeting with, and that was like going to school. Mm. Actually, I could say it was Doc McGee.
Oh.
Yeah. He was cool. And in retrospect, maybe things would have been a lot different had we gone with him, but we didn't. But I remember we were at his office for like 3 hours, and we went across the street to the Rainbow Bar and Grill. It was right there. And they kept it open for us, like, oh, Doc McGee's meeting with some guys. You know, let's keep it open. They got respect, you know. And then word got out, oh, those guys are Beautiful Creatures are meeting with Doc McGee. And our label heard it. And I don't think they loved the idea of us having a very 80s manager, because we had to blend in with new stuff. They weren't going to put us on tour with 80s acts. We had to go out with bands like Marilyn Manson and all that newer type of rock. So maybe that's a major reason we didn't go with Doc, but he was really nice and we learned so much meeting with him. And all these producers, and you had to weed out who really was interested in the band or who just saw it's a major label and there's a lot of money to make. You know, a producer will charge a label a ridiculous fee because the label is a big bank.
Did you end up owing money, or what, when it all was said and done? Usually you hear about, like,
yeah,
you
know, it's not like the individuals themselves. Well,
right.
Owe
I know,
money.
But
that's a common mistake people make, is thinking that if your record doesn't recoup, that you're in hock to the label for the rest of your life. No, it's a tax write-off for the label.
Right. Well, right. But they hold that money. If until you recoup, that's when they'll pay you back.
It's a strange business. I mean, this was before 360 deals, which is where the label gets a piece of every revenue stream, not just your record, but your t-shirts and your concerts and your VIP packages. And because they have to justify staying alive and being the big label that they are. But no, we, what was the question that got us here?
We were just talking about, contracts or Beautiful
Creatures. Right, owing, yeah.
Yeah, just money, money issues. That's what a lot of bands break up, because there's money issues. All of a sudden,
usually it's money. Yeah. They say creative differences, that means money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but we made this record and there was a lot of money wasted, which was actually the name of our first single, Wasted, but it wasn't about that. It should have been, but no, just stupid money spent on stupid things that, like I said, it was a learning experience. And I just watched all this waste. I'm like, oh my God, we were having that guy to mix one song and we're paying him how much? That's not the right guy. And it turned out it wasn't the right guy. And they paid him a ridiculous amount of money to try mixing one song. And just things like that. I could go on and on about it, but no, a photo shoot in Times Square where they put us up in a hotel and wardrobe and makeup. And it was in a high rise. And I think that price tag for that was 30-40 grand, something like that. Yeah. All recoupable under our record. And they use like 15% of your album sales to recoup the whole thing. It's a strange process and there's not a lot of transparency. And they act like they have no way of telling you solid figures and answers when you ask them questions about the numbers. But it's a game of obfuscation. They're going to play that game with you, and you need a manager that's really going to be on your side to watch out for your bottom line.
It's insane.
Learning experience.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
We talk about rock drummers, but you've got a wide swath of influences through. Sure. Who were some other drummers that possibly you wouldn't expect someone like you to have?
Oh, the unexpected influences.
Oh yeah, like yeah. Oh, I love this guy. Does lots insane things. Yeah, but like who? Throw out a few. Well, and why is that?
For people that would know me from Alice Cooper, yeah, there might be some things that are a surprise. But for drummers, anybody that talks to me, some things are obvious. I mean, I grew up in L.A., so at an early age, at 16, I was going to the Baked Potato Jazz Club, which is still there in Studio City. I play there sometimes, but it's tiny. It's a living room. And people know it from all over the world. It's famous. They walk in and go, this is it? Mm-hmm. But that's why it's so great. And a guy like Vinnie Colaiuta would play there back in the day. Like, he'd play all the time, so it wouldn't be jam-packed every time. And I'd stay both sets, and I'd sit at the perfect vantage point, like 10 feet away, watching and just soaking it in. That was school, you know. And I watched David Garibaldi play there. That's Tower Power's drummer. Well, my mentor, Greg Bissonette, would play there all the time. And just watching all these guys was such an education. And watching the band and watching how a band interacts on stage, that was important to see all that, and how they're reading sometimes the tunes they're playing, maybe sight reading charts, and there's improvisational sections and how they go from one solos to the next. And that was, I didn't realize at the time how much of an education that was. Jeff Porcaro, I saw play there. The list goes on. So those are very typical drummer influences, but maybe not every general rock fan would realize.
Not uncommon for rock drummers to be influenced by jazz.
Yeah, yeah, it's true.
So let me ask you about another drummer. I'd be remiss, my resident expert. What do you think of Terry Bozzio?
Huge influence. Yeah. Huge, yeah. I am pretty good buddies with him. I've known him since, well, maybe about 25 years now. And I remember thinking it was one of the greatest moments of my young career when I met him. There used to be this club. There's a lot of clubs that are just done back in the day. So you hear me say there used to be this venue. Mm-hmm. Well, it was in Canoga Park. It was Club M Mancini's. Do you remember that at all?
I do.
Do you?
Yes, I do.
Wow. I do
not. Well, they used to have a jam night every Tuesday, it was, and it went on for a couple of years. And I was 18, 19 when I was going to that. And this was, I think, the first time I ever played with a professional band. But you'd play double drums because the drummer in the house band was Mark Craney, who was most known for playing with Gino Vannelli, I Just Want to Stop, mm-hmm. that record, Jethro Tull, Tower of Power, amazing player, dealt with a lot of health issues, diabetes and things. There was a big benefit they had for him back in the day. And unfortunately, we lost him years ago, but he was the drummer in the house band, and you'd sit in and you'd play double drums with him because he was lefty. So they had to have a right-handed kit. And that was the challenge. You'd trade fours or eights with Mark, you know, a drum solo section they leave for everybody. And then what that turned into, that jam night, it turned into this thing they do about once a year, kind of like what we do at the drummer lunches, except this was playing, and they called it the Woodland Hills Drum Club. And it was Mark Craney, and it was Greg Bissonette, and it was Myron Grumbacher from Pat Benatar's band, Tristan Bowden from Chicago, Don Perry from Jethro Tull, all live in the West Valley. That's like drummer central. Best kept secret. But so I was the kid. I was Greg's student or his former student by then, and they would invite me up to play at these things, and they'd have three drum sets set up on stage with this band, and they'd trade eights. And I guess I played pretty okay one night, and Terry Bozzio approached me and introduced himself and said that he really liked a lot of the things I was doing. And I thought, this is amazing. I can't believe this is happening. And he called me a couple days later and got my address and sent me out a VHS of one of his solo drum concerts that no one had seen. And we became buddies, and he recommended me to Jennifer Batten a couple years later. I did a cool record with her.
It's phenomenal.
Yeah, because I grew up, you know, just idolizing a guy like him, not just Missing Persons. Mm-hmm. That was the first, which had great playing on it, man. Spring Session M, that record. That was a game changer for a lot of people. But then getting into UK, do you remember them at all?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was a big deal.
I do.
And, well, Frank Zappa, of course. I wasn't quite as big of a Zappa guy as other people were, but I did appreciate it. So that was really gracious and cool of Terry.
That's great. Were you going to mention a few You had a some flashes from the past.
It turns out we have a common common friend, I guess, maybe, and he told me to ask you about Offbeat.
Oh, who's the common friend?
Craig Fields, who is a cousin of Joel Singer.
Right. Yeah. I haven't seen him in a while.
Yeah.
Oh, Offbeat was cool. I have that somewhere on VHS, and I can't remember if I transferred that to MP4 file, but that was in high school, and it was the talent show at the high school that we went to, and it was kind of my idea. We should do like an all drummer thing. And it turned into six guys. And this was my junior year of high school for Joel and I. We were the two main drummers in this, and we had the two drum sets and then four percussion setups, you know, congas and rototoms and everything else. And we'd rotate. There was like three rotations. So everybody, all six of us, got to play double drums. But Joel Singer and I, we really liked Genesis a lot. We loved when Phil Collins and Chester Thompson would do double drums and do the same exact fills together. And so we said, oh, we got to do a solo like that where it's just note for note. And we spent hours in my bedroom. Talk about noise. I mean, two drum sets. The neighbors really love that. But we spent time at my house with the two drums, at his house. And this was just something that we really wanted to do. And we put together this great double drum solo, and we pulled it off. I'll watch the video today and think, how did I do that? Like, it was some crazy chops that we were doing, and I would come up with the lick, or he would come up with it, or he'd place it, you know, compositionally. And we had this part at the end where the other four guys would step off stage, and we had the final 2 minutes of doing our double drum thing, and the crowd roared so loud at the end of it, it scared me. It was so loud. But yeah, I have that on VHS, and we did it again the next year too, Offbeat. We called it Offbeat 2, the sequel. And because we were seniors then, and we were getting really weird and into very like metric modulation polyrhythms, and we had a great time. But the first year was the best, just because, you know, it was something no one had seen, and we won the talent show. And the funny thing is, I recently on Facebook said hi to a guy named Rob that was in the act that night. He was a baseball player, maybe also a football player, but there was a group of jocks that were also musicians. And so Rob was in the group called Horizon, and they played Runaway by Bon Jovi. And Rob was just ladies' man, and he's singing lead, and the girls went nuts, and they put them last. They were like the favorite to win, and we were like second out of 10 acts, and we won. And this guy, Rob, he was mad. We got beat by a bunch of drummers. This is, you know, and it's funny. I said hi to him on Facebook, maybe, you know, within the last month or two. And it's just cool. Facebook is still cool for that kind of thing, but I'll just never forget that. And there was a lot of talented people back in high school, back in the day.
It's where it all starts.
Yeah.
Did you play snare? What did you play in the band? In
snare
band? Was it all? It wasn't no quads or anything.
No, I did quads the last year in senior year, but I think I like snare the best.
Yeah,
but it was good that I did both, and I didn't even realize at the time that it was going to be that challenging. Snare when I was in ninth grade, I got thrown in the deep end, big time.
Dan Gillen.
Yeah, well, he helped me. A lot. Push it. He did. He helped me. Oh, no, yeah. He made me realize, all right, I can get through this. I can do this. I just got to practice. And you have to know that you could do it first.
Yeah, that's great.
Great instructors.
Humble beginnings.
It all begins. Anything else we got for a friend? What? Plug away. I know we talked about Alice Cooper. Anything else we can?
Well, the tour we mentioned, right? The good old summer tour. I mean, the Hollywood Vampires record, that's still a new record. Rise, it's called. Came out a few months ago. That's available in all formats, digital and box set. You know, gatefold album, whatever
we didn't even talk about being in the studio with Joe Perry and Alice. What is that about?
Geek out.
A lot of late nights. Hollywood Vampires. A couple of them literally are vampires. Johnny Depp and Joe Perry. They like to work late. And the very first demo recording session I did started at like 1:30 in the morning because I had a gig way down in Anaheim. This was NAMM a couple years ago. The NAMM convention week, and I was playing with Richie Sambora down there, and I was called to do this session to guarantee me, lock me in for the record. It was Tommy Hendrickson, New York guy, you know, he's like, dude, I need you to come down for this session. We got to make sure they know that you're the guy for this record, you know. And when is it? Wednesday. I got a gig. He said, doesn't matter. Come after. I said, it's in Anaheim. If I come after, I won't get there till 1:30 in the morning. He said, perfect. They're just getting going at that time. And yeah, I showed up like 1:30, whatever. And by the time I got recording, maybe it was closer to 2:30 or 3. And Johnny said, like, play something impossible. And I thought, like, no problem, because I'm really out of it. I just played a long gig. It was with Richie and several other artists. It was one of those gigs where I was backing up many people. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's good to be burnt out because your guard is down and you're not trying to do anything. You're just doing it. And I guess it went well enough to where Johnny and Joe, you can get a thing called demo-itis where you get just married to the way the demo sounds. And when it comes time to do the actual record, you don't want to change anything. You love the demo. And so I had to write down exactly whatever I did at 3 a.m. and replicate it on the actual record. But there were several nights of those demo sessions that would go late, and I'd be like nodding off and saying, all right, I'm going to get out of here. And Joe would be, oh, you're not leaving yet, are you? No, I guess not. Okay, what's next? And no, but I'm proud of that record. It was done in a way where there wasn't a lot of or any real post-production manipulation of tuning things or artificially lining up the drums with the program called Beat Detective. We wanted to avoid all that. We wanted to make a just rock, organic-sounding record. I'm proud of it.
That's great. Very cool.
And we got more tour dates with that coming up in Europe for your European listeners.
And we do have some.
I'm sure you do. Yeah. In August, September, we'll be out there. A bunch of dates already announced, like France, Italy, UK, Belgium, a lot of places.
Phenomenal.
We got you covered.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Glenn, for coming out. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you. Yeah. This was so great.
It's a great podcast. Usually I'm talking about drum gear and, right. You know, nothing wrong with that, but this is a little more general about...
Geek out.
Yeah. No, music geek.
Podcast allows you to go deep.
Yeah.
All right. stuff you really, well, I mean, yeah. Not that we like drum gear, but.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Well, thank you again, Glenn. And thank you, Holly, for helping me out here.
Oh, pleasure's mine. No, thank you. It was great to have you here.
Okay. Until next week, this is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frunino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.